All right, welcome into the latest edition of the That's So Cincinnati podcast. I'm excited. We're in the booth, Jason.
We are in the booth.
We are in the official podcast booth, coming you crystal clear. I hope. Paulina Jr., Jason Williams, PX extraordinaire, it's politics insider, all the things. I'm just a Bengals writer.
Grandpa PX.
Grandpa. Which, by the way, gotta be one of my favorite stories ever, which was the grandpa story from last week. If you haven't listened to last week's podcast, which was great.
Polly's a hit.
Yeah, one of our most listened to podcasts that we've done, the Polly Campbell All Food, All Everything, Best Restaurants. But in the back of that episode, there was a gem about a kid thinking that you were your son's grandfather. And I love that.
Kid at McDonald's, worker at McDonald's, where I've been three times in the past since lunch yesterday. Twice to get coffee, just twice for coffee.
Sure, whatever you say.
And now here I am stuffed into this little booth with you.
I know.
I need to stop eating so much McDonald's, man.
No, yeah, I'm going to make you stop the McDonald's if this is the way it's going to be, okay?
If we were only on TV right now, I mean, people would... I just think our popularity would go sky high.
That is not true. I can't think of a single scenario where we're better off on TV.
Are you wearing Old Spice, by the way? That's how close we are. I can tell.
It is Old Spice.
Axe body spray.
It's not Axe body spray. I'm not wearing Wolf Thorn, which is like the worst version. Yeah, no, that's an actual Old Spice brand is Wolf Thorn. I try to keep it with Classic. I wear Classic.
With the little glass, like white glass jar.
Yeah, well, you know, Old Spice likes to come up with ridiculous names.
I mean, I guess
stuff.
That's what I use since I'm a grandpa. And I use a little brush thing with the bowl to put my shaving cream on.
People did not come to this podcast to hear about our hygiene habits.
Yeah,
can we talk about politics or some stuff going on for a little bit? Just our guest, who's our guest going to be excited about this?
Jared Camras. He's a Democratic political consultant. A rising star in that realm, and has represented a lot of successful candidates locally and across the state. And
work with John Cranley, right?
Work with John Cranley
and his mayoral campaign,
David Mann,
yeah,
and Bridget Kelly in state. So he's done a lot of stuff, and he's still relatively young in his career, and he's a great guy, and I look forward to having him in.
Yeah, going to be great. Going to be excited to have him on. So we'll have that coming up a little bit. But first, let's do FC Cincinnati sort of back in the news a little bit. You know, you've got the groundbreaking is going on this week. Today, Tuesday, as we record this, actually. Mm-hmm. But you wrote this weekend about the fact that, look, the Columbus Crew got money from the state. $11 million more than FC?
Yes.
Correct? And the instant reaction is, why are they getting more money than us?
Yeah.
Right? Like, why people in Cincinnati? But you had kind of a detailed look as to why... It shouldn't be that reaction and what that means, but there's also a lot more going on with FC right now. But let's before we get into the ensuing fight that's about to happen at Cincinnati, let's talk about the state money and what does all that mean?
So the knee-jerk reaction, I think, is to think that Columbus, you know, the state house is, you know, poo-pooing on Cincinnati again, and that was my initial reaction because I think we think of us as being down here on an island by ourselves, and we think that they see us as being down here on an island. They see us as part of Kentucky. So, I mean, that's the knee-jerk reaction to this. But I wanted to explore it a little bit more, so I actually took an extra day, and I talked to about a half dozen people, both in Columbus, around here, everyone who's plugged into Columbus from different angles, Democrats and Republicans. And it turns out, you know, really no one saw this as this was a intentional shot at Cincinnati. This was more of Columbus is in a dire situation where they need this money to stay in Columbus. That's part of their deal with MLS is to stay in Columbus and get this downtown stadium.
Because Columbus could go to Austin right now. That's the team. That's where they could end up going. And this whole Save the Crew campaign is where they're at with it.
Exactly. So the state... legislature, the House, the Franklin County Government Commissioners, and the Columbus City Council all, I don't, they didn't meet, but they all essentially agreed that they would all kick in and help out. And so Columbus City Council gave $50 million, Franklin County gave $50 million, and the state house gave, or the house gave them $15 million. Now, this has come several months after FC only got $4 million out of the capital budget. However, again, the crew are in a dire situation, whereas FC Cincinnati, their stadium's not going to be done until 21, and now they have the opportunity to go back and ask for more money, and they I believe they're going to. And so, you know, no one kind of on the inside saw this as, oh, this was a direct shot at Cincinnati, that this was more of, and if you actually look back through history, the State House really treated Cleveland and Cincinnati fairly on the Browns, Indians, Reds, and Bengals stadiums. They gave like a very equal percentage amount of money for all those stadiums. And so really it was just it was really the crew's turn. They hadn't gotten any money for a stadium. You know, it was their turn for a new stadium, and they got $15
million. And we still don't know if they're even going to get that, right? I mean, there's no – They, if the team leaves, they're not going to build that.
Well, the team is all, it's all contingent on the stadium. So the team has already been guaranteed. It's a little bit of a difficult. They've already basically said that, hey, if you get this stadium locked in downtown by December 31st, that you're going to be fine to stay. So it was all contingent on this stadium deal that they can stay. And so it looks like they're in good shape.
Looks like they might get it.
They've gotten over $100 million in public money for it.
Wow. Yeah. And that was the whole thing when FC was going to go to MLS. Like, do you want these two teams? You know, from FC perspective, I think I never really knew which side they stood on that, because you want to have more ownership over the market, and you could kind of get some of those disenfranchised crew fans. But the rivalry is going to be great.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the Hell is Real rivalry is one of the best parts of FC's last few years, the games against Columbus, and I think that'll be great for business on both ends. Can we jump? Let's jump into the conversation now about the ensuing fight, because the groundbreaking is happening. And as you knew, it just couldn't go easily. It's not like you're just going to cruise on, they're going to build the stadium, and it's going to be great, and everybody's going to be happy. That's not how things roll around here. That would not be so Cincinnati. So what is the fight that's upcoming here?
Well, it's funny, because unlike Columbus, which their council passed 6-0 to give $50 million just like that to the crew, unlike them, we do the exact opposite, and we fight over every single thing about our stadium deals. And, you know, there's such a long history here. We've talked about ad nauseum about public money for stadiums and the fact that the Reds and Bengals stadiums, the Bengals stadium in particular, did no favors for FC Cincinnati in terms of how they were going to go about their stadium deal. Now, they've been sloppy at times, and the PR has been bad, and the rush job has been, that's on them. But so where we're at right now, there are still some fights coming down the pike. The city still owns some of the land that FC Cincinnati absolutely has to have. One of them is a parking lot behind the District 1 police headquarters. And so right now that's valued at, I'm told it's valued at $1.6 million, and that the team and a city council member, when they were working out the deal back in the spring to get the stadium deal done, agreed that the city would sell that to the team for a dollar. Well, they didn't get that in writing. Apparently it's in emails, but it's not in a contract. And so now we're looking at a fight over that. So whether FC Cincinnati is going to have to pay a dollar or $1.6 million. It's complex and it's hard to explain, but it also involves FC Cincinnati turning around, and then, because this is the parking lot for the police, where the police cars who are running on emergencies park right behind the district. So then part of the deal also is that FC Cincinnati needs to build them a new parking facility essentially across the street where the WCET garage is. And so then that's also a sticking point on, you know, will they pay the $1.6 million for the garage or the current parking lot, and then how much are they going to have to pay for a new garage, and is that going to be part of the deal?
Somebody's going to have to eat that money. I mean, regardless, I mean, somebody is going to, it's not like this is going to shut down the project. I mean, so it's just someone's going to get the raw end of the deal here.
Ultimately, I mean, and I think, I don't see city council coming around on this one. Right now, they have three votes. And here's one of the kickers is that Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman has to abstain from every FC Cincinnati vote from here on out because his brother, Albert, owns Joston Construction, which is one of the contractors for building the stadium, along with Turner Construction. So there's essentially now there's a vote that's gone for FC Cincinnati. So right now, generally speaking, you've got a 4-4 split. However, on this parking lot deal, there's only about three people right now who are in favor of it. And I'm not sure they're gonna. I don't see it coming around. I think ultimately that FC Cincinnati is gonna have to eat $1.6 million.
And they're already in so many. Like, what, you know, that's what the thought is. I mean, if you're in this far, what? And it's crazy to say. What is $1.6 million when you're in as deep as they are?
Well, I think the fact that this goes back to this is how the game is played. That on these deals, you try to get as much money out of the taxpayers as you can, and they feel like they've spent a lot of money on buying up all the private properties. They've overpaid for several of the properties, and so they also feel like they were promised this parking lot for a dollar. And so you know, these are business people, and this is how people make money.
Going back on what you said is ridiculous, and just this is just par for the course crap, right? It feels like, I mean, if that was, you know, I know you got to get it in writing, but I mean, it's in the emails and you said that this is what you were going to do. And
I've been told it's in emails. I mean, you want to make that clear. I've not seen emails, but I've been told by a reliable source that it is in emails. And what does that mean? I don't think that means anything when it comes to, that's certainly not a legally binding document.
Yeah, right. But it's I guess, does trust even matter at this point, or is that eroded to... Through this whole process, this is just the beginning, though. I mean, you've got how many more things like this are going to come up? So many, right? I would think.
Yeah, well, there's still some zoning things that need to be approved. The zoning actually for the stadium needs to be approved. It won't be a hurdle getting it through the zoning commission, but then again, the council then has to turn around and vote on what the zoning commission says. And you know, right now, it's a little tepid in terms of the FC Cincinnati support. My take on it is certainly don't just give them a blank check, but we've got to get beyond this. The team is coming to the West End. They're building a stadium. They've done a lot. They've made a lot of concessions. They're building a privately funded stadium, which is pretty much unheard of in American sports. Certainly, they're getting 30-some million for infrastructure. But we've got to get down the road, and we can't sit here and nitpick and continue to fight over this at city council that Major League Soccer is coming. And, you know, I'm not saying don't question things. Don't, you know, look at the details, make sure everything is figured out. But at some point, we've got to treat this like the Columbus City Council did and say, do we want these guys or not? And the weird thing is that we already said we do want them there,
right?
And that Major League Soccer said yes. And so let's put the petty fighting down and let's get down the road and get these guys in their new stadium in 21 and, you know, start the Major League Soccer.
I'm with you. I agree. We're going to put it behind us too. I think we move on.
But great.
For now, we'll move it on. Let's get Jared in here, right? So let's bring in Jared, and we'll come back after that and chat a little bit more about our That's So Cincinnati moments, of which I'm excited about too, because next week between Christmas and New Year's, you put out a request for the That's So Cincinnati-est moments of the year, and you got tons of responses. So we're going to do an entire episode just dedicated to all the That's So Cincinnati moments. We'll have that coming up next week on TSC. But for now, let's bring in Jared. All right, excited to have Jared Kammersinger join us, the principal of Rivertown Strategies. You talked him up right at the beginning, Jay, and, you know, I'm intrigued, you know, when you touch on, so you're in so many different buckets. I mean, what is your background, first of all? How do you get into this world, and what exactly is a, you know, the principle of Rivertown Strategies? What is all that?
You know, it's amazing how few times I get asked that question, Paul. So I grew up in Cincinnati. I'm from the greater Cincinnati area. I'm born and raised in Blue Ash, went to Sycamore High School, but I left to make the trek up 71 and go to Ohio State and spend some time in Columbus. And it was at Ohio State where I kind of started going down these dual tracks that I'm on. One, I was like immediately attracted to the world of politics and campaigns, and both the strategy of it, but also kind of the romance of, you know, battling it out, you know, in the kind of civic arena of ideas, and, you know, what strategies and tactics are the best. And then I also, when you're at Ohio State, you have no choice but to fall in love with the athletics. Mm-hmm. And not only the product on the field, but the business of college athletics. And while I was at Ohio State, I had the opportunity to get involved closely with the athletic department on the University Athletic Council, and was there during the conference expansion that both added Nebraska to the Big Ten Conference, and then at the tail end of my time there, Rutgers in Maryland. So I saw kind of the more tectonic shifts in college sports at the macro level, and I was also there when we had 3 football coaches in 1 year. And it was that was also, you know, an interesting time, and kind of give you a sneak peek behind the curtain of the way the business of college athletic work.
And you got to look at that time was so fascinating, from the moment Syracuse and Pittsburgh pushed the first domino yep. over to everyone waiting, saying Rutgers and Maryland. I mean, that entire time was so chaotic and so insane, and still the ripple effects are still just hammering people, none more than here in this city. But it's like, you know, it's amazing how much college football has, and that being the driver of all college athletics, has changed so dramatically right. over the last, I mean, that wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't. And the theory of the case is predicated entirely on a media model that already doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. It was predicated on the idea of being in as many big media markets as possible, mm-hmm. getting the carriage and subscriber fees for your conference network. And with the way cord cutting has picked up at exponential levels over the past few years, and you know, it's not so much about cable subscribers anymore. It's about delivering your content to your fans and consumers in different ways. You know, the model that made Rutgers and Maryland great decisions at the time maybe is not so much the case anymore. And it's just very interesting because, you know, it's, I would say conference expansion's at a pause. It's not finished, and there will be another phase, and probably another phase after that. And as the business side reacts to this new media landscape we live in, you know, the conferences and the schools that succeed will be the ones that are the most innovative and are able to anticipate those changes and position themselves to get out in front of it.
Yeah. Is this something that would you say you're more passionate about the sports, the politics and the business side of sports than you are about politics?
You know what's interesting is I don't see them as that different.
Yeah.
In fact, I see them as having a lot of similarities that maybe don't make the most sense. At their most basic levels, it's a chess game, and some, you know, players in the game have certain strengths and weaknesses, and others have certain strengths and weaknesses. And your job, whether it's in campaigns with a candidate or whether you are, you know, a member of a board of trustees of a university, is to how do you best position your asset and minimize your strengths relative to the rest of the board. And you know, it's fun because you can see it manifest itself on, you know, game day, and that's different than seeing, you know, your campaigns and your strategies manifest itself on election day. But to me, there's so many similarities that I almost view them as, you know, being the same, two different sides of the same coin.
Is Rivertown Strategies kind of in that world?
You know, for me, it's the relationships I made while at Ohio State. I mean, look, we were in the bunker with Luke Fickell in 2011, and, you know, now seeing him succeed here in Cincinnati is something I really enjoy, just because no one deserves it more than that guy. I mean, he was given an impossible task at Ohio State. He not only performed, you know, admirably with, you know, the biggest battlefield promotion one can get, and being told Memorial Day weekend, hey, you're the head coach for the next football season, and having players leave and coaches leave, and then sticking around when Urban came through, you know, for the 3 or 4 years that he did, you know, that speaks to the kind of guy that he is. But based on the relationships I made there, you know, I'm never going to be out of that game. It's too fascinating for me, and I learned too much. And I whatever way I'm able to be helpful in it, I like to be.
I
had a question. You came in to John Cranley's campaign here after the primary, correct?
No, I was. I've been with John since the end of his first year of the first term. So I've almost been with John for almost 5 years.
What have you seen? How has John grown and changed over that time? And how did the intensity of the last election, you think, change his perspective? Or did it?
That's a great question. I mean, I will say this about the mayor. There are very few rooms that he's in which he's not the smartest person in the room. And there are very few people who understand the ins and outs of municipal government, whether it be the finances and economics of municipal government or just the way different coalitions and stakeholders interact with each other than John Cranley. And he is absolutely a master tactician on the political side and on the governing side. You know, 2017 had its ups and downs for the mayor. And one of the things that really impressed me about him on a human level is that after the primary came and he got walloped by Yvette Simpson, and you know, I think he would even describe it in those same words, is how willing he was to not necessarily doubt his instincts that had gotten him through, you know, a long career on city council and getting elected mayor in the first place and a pretty successful first term as mayor, and you know, with 6 months to go, be willing to question all of that, recalibrate, readjust, listen to experts, bring in new people, and then come away with a resounding victory in the fall. I mean, that I think speaks to him in terms of, you know, he's brilliant, and you know, I think there are various people, you know, even including I think his detractors who would disagree. I mean, he is a smart person. He is a capable person. But sometimes the smartest people can be the most stubborn and the most sure of themselves. And John Cranley is not that. He is willing to take, you know, he's willing to go into halftime and throw out the playbook that got him there. And if he thinks that's what he needs to do to win, and he'll do it. And he owned it. I mean, he from that primary through the summer into the fall, I don't know how many tens of thousands of doors he personally knocked on, because you know, he had a bunch of smart people telling him that's what he had to do, and he went and did it, and he worked his butt off, and the results speak for themselves. So he definitely changed, but I think it's a testament to, you know, it's one thing to be brilliant, and the man is, obviously, but to be able to take that kind of result and realize that some of the core tenets of your philosophy of campaigns that got you there maybe need to be revisited and then execute on them, that's a tough thing to do, and he did it.
Yeah. One thing that, you know, Cranley obviously is a lightning rod and a polarizing figure. But one thing, if he likes you, he will help you in the party. And right. you've done some work with that as well through his leadership pack.
Right.
Is that something that's continuing on? Is he continuing to support other candidates?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the 2018 election showed us is that Hamilton County is changing or has changed. And on top of that, the state of Ohio is changing, and they're changing in completely opposite directions. And I think what that means for Mayor Cranley, and I think what it means for Democrats as a whole across the state, and even here locally, is that we have a bigger responsibility as Cincinnati and Hamilton County Democrats to help support candidates, not just here in our own backyard, but around Ohio. And you know, he does a really good job of not only being someone who offers financial support through his political action committee, but also, you know, works with candidates, makes himself available to answer questions, give advice, and that's borne a lot of fruit for him. I mean, Zach Klein, who's now the Columbus City Attorney and maybe the third highest ranking law enforcement official in the state, I mean, I think he would tell you he wouldn't be in that position without the advice that he got from John. John supported him financially too, but it's a friendship. It's developing those kinds of relationships, and that's what he'll keep doing.
I want to jump back and, you know, growing up in Blue Ash, were your parents, your dad, rabbi, your mom, a teacher, right?
Right.
Were they politically engaged? Was that politics thing implanted in you early on in your life?
It was, but not in like an electoral politics, you know, way that one might expect based on what I do. You know, I'm the youngest of three. My sister and my brother and I think all benefited from my parents making very clear the values that we were expected to have. They modeled them for us, and to care about, you know, the world around you and how you can make an impact on the world around you. And, you know, the way that that manifests itself for me as I got older and started to make a career was getting involved in politics and public policy. And, you know, my sister went on to become a teacher, and she's getting her PhD in education policy. My brother practices law, and he's dabbled in politics too, obviously. Yeah. And,
you know, this is Micah, your brother Micah. Right. Well, he was the Ohio State student body president.
He was. Correct? He was a student body president.
Did you work with him there?
Yeah, so the first campaign that I ever worked on was my brother's campaign for student body president, which sounds silly, but at Ohio State, those are big operations, and you got 60,000, you know, students.
Well, I mean, look at who's been in that role before. AFTAB, Pure Vol,
Josh Mandel. John Kasich tried twice and couldn't crack it. So, you know, it is interesting because there is a pedigree that comes with it.
No, I'm sorry.
There is a pedigree that comes with it. Those campaigns become serious operations, and that campaign gave me the bug for it.
Do they raise money and everything?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Do you have to file reports?
Yep. There's an elections governance. I completely forget. I think it was called. Yeah. It might have actually been called the Elections Governance Board, but there is a body that oversees and maintains the integrity of the elections. And yeah, it's serious stuff. It's and you know, it sounds silly, I think, talking about it now, but you know, in that moment, it's the most serious thing in the world, right?
Of course.
And, you know, we had a blast doing it. My brother's my closest friend, and you know, that was what gave me, and not only that experience, but him winning. Serving as student body president, he was president. He got elected. That would have been the spring of 2010. So he served 2010 to 2011, and that's kind of when we're talking about all this stuff was happening with football and conference expansion. So on top of the athletic stuff and the things that he was doing for the student body, it was just fun to be in the thick of it with him.
And through that experience, through Micah's experience as student body president, your experience with the athletic stuff, you guys got to know Gordon Gee really well, huh?
Yeah, so Dr. Gee was the president at Ohio State. He was on his second tour of duty when we were there. He served earlier, I think probably a decade or decade and a half before. And he became like a father figure to both of us. And, you know, obviously he played such a big role, not only in changing Ohio State. I mean, Ohio State, you know, when you were growing up, was probably looked at very differently than the way it is now. And mostly for the positive, and I think Gordon gets a lot of credit for that. And obviously he was, you know, talk about the conferences and the schools that can be the ones that are more anticipatory and innovative and can see the changing landscape. Gordon's always been a visionary, and people can say what they want about some of the additions with Rutgers and Maryland, but, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, when Purdue is getting a bigger conference payout from their media rights than Alabama is, that's a testament to the leadership. And when you're the president of Ohio State, you're not the commissioner of the Big Ten, but you're the commissioner of the Big Ten works for you. And Gordon was always innovative, and the Big Ten network was a very new thing that he helped spearhead. Yeah. The conference expansion was stuff that he helped spearhead. And
still, you know, stay in touch with him. He's now
the
president.
Yeah, he's now the president of West Virginia. You know, very fortunate that he's remained a friend and mentor and ally throughout the years. And West Virginia is where he started his career as university president. I think he's not doing a second tour of duty there. And, you know, there are very few people more popular in West Virginia than he is. And he's doing a great job there, too. He's doing a lot of the same things at Ohio State. And, you know, they're in an interesting position, too, where they're a member of the Big 12 Conference, and they're the opportunity to be innovative and visionary. And he's, again, helping to lead the charge there.
Two years ago, I took a hiatus from covering politics, and I was just sort of a special assignment, I guess, to sports. I covered the UC's song and dance with the Big 12, and it was my understanding that I never landed an interview with him, and I tried pretty hard. But it was my understanding he was very supportive of UC getting into the Big 12.
Yeah, but, you know, when he was at Ohio State, you know, people remember he – one of the reasons, you know, the kind of cloud of circumstances that caused him to leave Ohio State in 2013 was around some comments he made about – other schools. That took place in a meeting of the athletic council that I sat in, so I was in that meeting. What didn't necessarily get reported, some of the very complimentary things said about UC. And while they were never a target for the Big Ten, I think Gordon's always appreciated the role that, as the largest you know, employer in a growing city and the largest magnet of talent in a city like Cincinnati, that UC has. And certainly, it certainly wouldn't surprise me that those his feelings, his otherwise, you know, generally positive conception of UC is probably only maintained, if not gotten stronger, since he's left.
Let me ask you this. While we're talking, this was a topic that came up last week when you're talking about Ohio State and your perspective as a Cincinnatian, having lived in Columbus, and the issue of does Columbus hate Cincinnati came up last week
when
the State House gave, and we talked about this at the top of the show here, when the State House gave Columbus Crew $15 million for a stadium. Is that – what's your take on that? Does Columbus hate us? Do we hate them? Or is that all just
No, I mean, look, I don't know if it's hate. I think there is sort of a component of, you know, when you're there – You're top of mind, right? When you're in Columbus, you're surrounded by the Save the Crew signs. You're interacting with the people who work at Columbus City Hall, and the people who work for the Columbus Partnership, which is kind of their chamber. And you know, so I think it's, you know, when you're out of sight, you're out of mind. We're 100 miles down the road, and you know, part of it, I think Cincinnati has cultivated this reputation of kind of being the Republic of Cincinnati, and it's something I actually like and find really charming about this area, but sometimes it doesn't always work to our benefit, especially when they're doling out money in Columbus. I think if we had this conversation in Cleveland, they'd probably say something similar. I know for sure.
Really, I was going to ask you.
Yeah, I know for sure in Toledo, you know, the Toledo Blade probably 2 or 3 years ago ran a series of, you know, what if Toledo seceded and went to Michigan, and, you know, would it be net positive for them? And I think this issue is probably – this discussion's had in all corners of the state. I think it might be a little bit more pronounced here. Because we are on the border and we've always kind of had our own unique identity separate from the rest of the state. Look, like, we are separate from the rest of the state. We're a city of hills. Nothing in the rest of the state, the metropolitan areas, are like that. We were never a blue-collar town. You know, this has always been a white-collar company town. Yeah. And you know, as the northern part of the state grew on the manufacturing stuff, you know, we either stagnated or grew because of, you know, either, you know, livestock and being Porkopolis, not, you know, not taking the railway when we could have, and instead doubling down on the waterway. Chicago took the railway. Look what happened to them. And we've just been a little bit separate. And it's true in athletics. It's true in politics. I mean, look, one of the unique opportunities, you asked about the mayor earlier, as a Democrat, the path to victory in Ohio now includes running up the score in Cincinnati and Hamilton County, whereas 12 years ago when Sherrod Brown first ran for the U.S. Senate in 2006, he won statewide by double digits and lost Hamilton County by double digits.
Done work for Sherrod as
well. Right, yeah, yeah. Sherrod's been a client, and now, you know, Sherrod wins statewide. He won by 6, but he won Hamilton County by 18.
Wow.
And you know, the reverse is true too. Rich Cordray loses statewide by 6. He wins Hamilton County by 6. So there's been this complete inversion in only 12 years, which 12 years in politics is a very long time. But for a state like Ohio, which hasn't had these crazy demographic changes like Georgia, Arizona, it just goes to show you how unique we can be. And as Cincinnati has assumed more power in terms of you don't get to a statewide election without doing well here, regardless of what party you are, I think you'll start to see our influence increase a little bit in Columbus. And keep in mind, like, you know, Bob Taft is from down here. Mike DeWine is from Southwest Ohio. And, you know, I think Columbus and the way it relates to the rest of the state changes with each administration and who's in power in the State House. And John Kasich was the governor of Columbus, you know. He was from Westerville. He lived at home when he was the governor. And I think, you know, it'll change when Mike DeWine is from when he's sworn in and, you know, is still kind of very much in connection with his roots in Southwest Ohio. And, you know, these things ebb and flow. But there's always some degree of that kind of disconnect. And I don't think that'll ever be completely gone. But Cincinnati's doing a much better job of starting to close the gap.
Let me ask you one more thing. We'll get you out of here.
Yeah.
I'll put you on the spot a little bit. So in your entire career, is there one campaign, one thing that you accomplished that you're most proud of at this point, or even when an issue, something you helped turn the tide on? Or
that's a good one.
I know it can be hard because you've done a lot of stuff, but is there something that sticks out to you?
You know, that's a good one. I think what's interesting for me is the ones that immediately pop into my head are the ones that lost, not the ones that won. You know, I it's funny, like, you have to, I think, to do anything right, it means failing a couple times first, right? And so, you know, my brother ran for state representative in 2014 and lost. He lost to a guy named Jonathan Deaver, who just got beat this time around by Jessica Miranda in a very close race. My brother ran the kind of race that I'm incredibly proud of. I managed the campaign. I'm incredibly proud of the campaign we ran. I'm incredibly proud of his performance as a candidate. You know, what's interesting is I've developed a relationship now with Jonathan Deaver. I actually spoke with him yesterday, and you know, look, I'm a Democrat. I like to see Democrats holding as many seats as possible, and now it's going to happen in that district that I grew up in and that we tried so hard to win. And you know, I think putting some of the wheels in motion in races like that and seeing them bear fruit, maybe not because of me, but down the line because of some of the work we put in, is meaningful to me. And you know, it's just funny talking to Jonathan about how, you know, the race, he still thinks, despite having lost the time around, the toughest race he ran was the one he beat my brother in. And it's just, it's a blast. And that, so it's those kinds of things that pop into my head. Yeah.
This is a segment of the show where I ask the last question after the last question, and Paul rolls his eyes.
Yep.
Fortunately, we're on audio and not video.
That's right. I didn't shave today. So.
Okay, one quick thing. One politician right now who's maybe under the radar that you see is a rising star, up-and-comer, that people should be keeping an eye on.
Locally?
Could be someone you represent, someone you don't represent, or you've worked for locally. Yeah, someone not a greater Cincinnati, but they could be in the State House, they could be City Hall, Hamilton County.
No, I think, you know, someone you wrote a story about last week, my client is Representative Bridget Kelly, who she just got elected her second term. She ran unopposed. I think it's a testament to her strength as a legislator. She is whip smart. She's now a member of leadership within her caucus. And I think we're going to see, especially after the new year, the way the State House is going to pick its leadership for a new speaker, or the way they're going to pick their priorities. Despite being in a super minority, Democrats actually have an opportunity to help shape that conversation. And because of Bridget's reputation within her caucus and without, you know, outside of her caucus, she's going to be a big player in that. And, you know, I think the nice thing about Bridget is, and she'll kill me for saying this, but she is a rising star who the State House is not her last stop, nor should it be.
Yeah.
And I know whatever comes next for her, she's going to make that decision of what to run for, not because it's something to climb the ladder, but because it's something she feels like she can make a difference in. And whatever comes next for her, I think she will run and she'll win, and she'll continue to make an impact for more people.
Bridget is one of those rare, I feel like it's almost like she's, it's weird to say this, that, you know, she's not a loudmouth on social media. She makes her promises and lives up to them. She works hard to work across the aisle, and I've had Republicans tell me that they are so impressed with her through her first 2 years in Columbus. And yet, she doesn't get a lot of press or a lot of attention because of that.
The other thing I'll add to that too, Jason, is I think very few people do constituent services as well as she does.
Yeah.
People who, you know, a lot of times when people call their state rep, it's because of a Medicare, Medicaid thing, and she does that kind of stuff great. But a lot of times when people call their state rep, they're calling them, but actually calling about something the city needs to be doing or the county needs to be doing, and they just don't know who to call. And they happen to call their state rep, and, you know, I think there are a lot of people who, when a call like that comes to their office, they'll say, oh, just call, you know, the city or the county or whatever. Her office staff and Hope, who is her legislative aide, is fantastic and a huge asset for Bridget, too. They'll get those calls, and even if it's something that's not within the state government, if it's something at City Hall, they'll call down to City Hall and help get it resolved for that person, even though it's not a state issue. They just happen to call their office. I mean, she does office hours in coffee shops all across her district.
Yeah, she does,
and, you know, it's the stuff that you say it's not sexy, you grind it out, but that's what being in public service means, and she does that to a T.
I have a lot of respect for Bridget, and I'm not surprised that you would say that she makes that happen for her constituents.
Yeah. And I mean, we've not heard the last of her. I mean, she's just getting started.
Great.
Jared, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate you joining. Even though you're associated with the second best college in Ohio behind Ohio University. It's great to have you on. I appreciate all the perspective. Great stuff that you've been doing.
Thanks
here.
For having me, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate it. Thanks, bud.
All right, much thanks to Jared Cameras for joining us. I'm super intrigued by all that. I mean, to be in the middle of the entire expansion, Big 12, everything else that was going on there, to see that from the ground floor had to have been fascinating to be on the inside of. And I can only imagine, you know, what the next level of that stuff will be.
Yeah, Jared's one of those guys. He's just a tremendous relationship builder, and he's so humble. He's perfect for that behind the scenes, making things happen. And I have a lot of respect for him. And he's one of the good guys in politics. And I wish him all the success that he's had so far. He's in his career, and I know he's going to go a long way.
I thought his view of John Cranley and as a guy and how he adjusted and what it said about him as a person after losing to a vet was really, really interesting answer and really telling of maybe who the mayor kind of is as a guy, which, you know, I think just most people don't really, in the average person, you know, I like to play the role of average Cincinnati guy. I don't think they really have much of an idea of who John Cranley is as a person. They know some of his policies and things like that, but as far as who he is, I don't really know that people really understand that type of stuff. It's really good, cool to hear some of that personality background to really get a better view of him.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And no one knows it better than Jared. Been right there alongside him and has had to tell him how things go sometimes, tell him some things he didn't want to hear. And you got to give credit to Cranley for listening to people like Jared and Jake and Cade and consultants and Chandra Youngbluth, who became his campaign manager last year. People who weren't afraid to say, look, this isn't working and you need to change some things. And he did. And that's a rare thing in politics. There are a lot
of rare thing anywhere.
It is. It is in any kind of industry, and especially for someone like John Cranley, who's very Type A and pretty set in his ways, and for him to adjust that way, certainly you have to give him some credit for that.
All right, Grandpa, time to move on. Let's.
What?
Grandpa.
Thanks.
Let's. It's time for That's Cincinnati Moment of the Week, which
dun dun dun
is our last individual That's So Cincinnati Moment of the Year, because next week we're going to share the That's So Cincinnati-est moments of the entire year from all the submissions that you got. So we've got that coming. But this week is one more, and I think I've got a good one.
What do you got?
I think I got a good one. Well, first of all, shout out to the folks at my wife's Christmas party, to those that came up to me and said, you know what's so Cincinnati is me coming up to you saying that's so Cincinnati that I'm coming up to you to tell you that I listen to That Cincinnati podcast.
That's
it
sweet.
Was very meta and fun, and I'm just happy. I'm just happy anytime people keep coming up and saying that they listen to the podcast.
That's great.
It's very exciting.
It's all because of me.
So that's partially the moment. The other part of it is this. At the Christmas party, you know, once people start leaving and things like that, you end up with a couple of tables where people are just sitting around, having a drink, telling stories, whatever. And inevitably, we were at a table, and every single one of us, there's probably 8-9 people at the table, went to a Cincinnati Catholic high school. And to the point you're going around like, okay, where'd you go to high school? Where'd you go to high school? Did you go to, you were St. X, your LRO, your Molar guy? And it was just like, wow, this is the Cincinnati-est thing that you could ever do. And then we started talking about JV Roger Bacon football.
Oh,
you know, it always leads to sort of the same place. Larry Flint stories were being swapped. I'm just like, could this be a more Cincinnati conversation? And at that point, I realized that this is my So Cincinnati moment, is sitting at a Cincinnati Christmas party talking about what Catholic high schools you went to and all those kinds of stories. It seems like it always ends up in so many of the same places with these types of functions.
All you needed was some Pete Rose and some Boss Cox, man.
I don't know how Pete didn't come up.
Seriously.
I mean, I was ready for him to walk in the door and start betting on the ponies right there.
Don't get no more.
We were at Belterra.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you were.
I'm surprised he wasn't there betting on the ponies at the table right next to us.
He might have been.
Wearing those
bad white eel skin shoes or whatever. Good Lord, those things are terrible.
You ever seen that jacket he would wear? The one that's like all different colors. You know what I'm saying? He wears it all the time.
He would wear it to Reds games.
So my cousin actually dubbed him the Fresh Prince of Cheviot in that jacket. Because it does. It looks like when Will Smith on Fresh Prince used to turn his jacket inside out and it was all those different colors with cornflake.
And then when he was on Fox, he would wear those like button-up shirts that had no collar on them.
Ugh. Pete. Yeah, he's. You know what's so Cincinnati? Us sitting here bemoaning Pete Rose.
Yeah.
Actually, if it'd be more Cincinnati if we were sitting here talking about how he's still the greatest.
It'd be even more Cincinnati if we were sitting here talking with him about how he was the greatest.
I don't think we have that kind of money yet.
Yeah.
You can't. You're not doing anything with Pete for free.
No, you're not. Have you ever interviewed Pete? I've interviewed him twice.
I have, sort of. Not really, though. I was there. He did the our sports awards the first year when I was the host. Doc did a long sit-down with them. So I was there for that. And I've been, you know, done, like, partial interview, but no, I've never had, like, a one-on-one.
So I did a one-on-one with him twice when I was at the Cincinnati Post. One was on the phone, and then he was doing an autograph session at the Western Hills Mall. It was some mall up in
that's Glenway. So Cincinnati.
I don't know what it's called now, but that's where, like, there's a Dillard's there or something.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it is it was amazing how many little details he remembered about. I interviewed him about his 44-game hitting streak, and the fact he remembered so many little details about it, it made me realize, I'm like, this is probably like the gambler in you, that you can know so many little details and numbers about things that you gamble on.
And as a hitting savant, that's part of who you are too. I mean, you know what I mean? You have to remember all those details about every time you faced a guy and what he threw and how it looked and things like that.
Yeah.
That's part of who you are.
Anyway, this is my Cincinnati moment of the week, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I was sitting here talking about Pete Rose.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
How bad is that?
Yeah, it's
bad lives.
Look.
I borrowed that from Tom Gamble, Richard Skinner.
Yeah.
It's our bad lives.
Bad lives.
The angry guys.
The angry guys, yeah. We should get them on. We had Skinny on our Bengals Beat podcast, actually, on Thursday. We did a media roundtable.
Very nice.
Kind of discussing Marvin, but it's always good to have those guys.
Was he
angry? He's always kind of angry, but he wasn't like an angry guy. It was noted that he has a podcast over at Local 12.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
And they've with Rick Broering, he also has done work here with us, and a good friend who they were joking about how they end up talking about ghosts a lot, and they should almost have their own ghost podcast. And I have a ghost story. We don't have time for it because I totally believe in ghosts. Ghosts are absolutely real. They're a real thing.
Stupid.
What do you mean stupid?
They're not real.
Have you ever seen a ghost?
No.
I've seen two ghosts. I've seen two ghosts, totally. But I'm not going to go there anyway, but I'm just letting you know that's what we were talking about.
You're lying.
Anyway. All right, well, let's wrap it up. So between Christmas and New Year's, we're going to bring you our That's So Cincinnati-est Moments of the Year. So a special episode over the holidays. And then
based on your feedback.
Yeah,
your feedback.
You, the That's So Cincinnati listener who we love, who are continuing to listen to the show. And again, subscribe. Go on to iTunes, please. You can give us a review. Tell us how great we are.
Five-star
reviews,
baby.
That's what we need. We are fragile egos, and we need to be told that we're great all the time. So
that's why we got Amanda here now. She's
going to tell us afterwards.
Special
that we're not
shout
so
out
great.
To Amanda.
Yeah,
Amanda Rossman.
Amanda Rossman doing our producing for us now.
She's going to tell us how great
time.
We are.
We're big time. You know what's going to happen though is people are going to realize you guys really aren't that great, and they're going to take Amanda away from us and make us do our production again.
Folks, I hope that you're able
tell everybody how great it sounds.
Yeah, I hope you're able to, because I know we've gotten a lot of feedback on our production and
so we're trying to up it.
And so hopefully this came at you more crystal clear today.
Yeah.
And all thanks to Amanda for that.
Yeah, and thanks to Jerry Cameras for joining us earlier. Great to have him on. And again, so we'll be back next week on the That's Cincinnati podcast.
Wait. One thing. Since we're now doing this professionally produced, we're now in a booth,
in
a sound booth. This is going to up my singing game. I'm not going to do it today. But look forward to it in future episodes, folks.
I know this feels more like you're about to bust a verse out or something.
Well, it's like, if people could see, it's like one of those little music studio things with a little screen over the microphone, headphones on. Man, I so badly want to bust out some Richard Marx, man. But,
I'm just going to, I just don't want that. You talk about bad lives. I'm stuck in the booth with you while you do this. So anyway, all right. Well, thanks everybody for listening to That's So Cincinnati podcast. We will catch you next week on our special That's So Cincinnatiest of 2018 episode. Thanks everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you later.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.